WBUR.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. They are the never-ending nine. They've been appointed for life and blessed with longevity. Not since the early 19th century has the Supreme Court sat for so long without a single new appointment. This week marks the beginning of the ninth term of 5-4 votes, fewer decisions each year, and surprise rulings. In the most conservative post-war court, abortion rights have prevailed. Clergy-led prayer at public school graduations has not. And since 1986, Chief Justice William Rehnquist, a Nixon appointee in 1972, has led the charge. His once minority voice on the famously liberal Earl Warren's court is the conservative majority voice now, a quietly but carefully cultivated ideology that puts states' rights above Washington's and claims school vouchers as a victory. And then there's Bush v. Gore. Some say that 2000 presidential decision of the never-ending nine will be this court's definitive legacy. Others disagree. Listeners, what's your ruling on the Rehnquist court? How will this nine decide this term's issues of security versus civil liberties? And if, as speculation suggests, Rehnquist retires before George Bush's first term expires, what's next for the highest court in the land? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I am joined tonight from Charlottesville, Virginia, by Dahlia Lithwick, senior editor and Supreme Court correspondent for Slate.com. Good evening and welcome, Dahlia Lithwick.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guest.
And Jack and guests and everyone, 1,000 apologies for the top of the show. The tape was bad. The engineer is on his way to Slobovia, but it's a round-trip ticket. We love him. And the house grammarians will all be called in later. Dahlia Lithwick, you have written so marvelously for Slate about the Supreme Court. You've got a ringside seat there. We want to talk about the big issues that this court has framed. But the fact is, one of the most interesting things right now is just how long these nine have sat together. Take us into this court, and don't go first to the Chief Justice, but some of the justices around. Give us a thumbnail of the men and women who sit together, have sat together now going into their ninth term. Who are these characters?
Well, I think characters is the operative word, and I think that's sort of the heartbreaking part, is that the public doesn't always have a sense that these are nine very dramatic personalities, you know, each and every one of whom is worthy of an opera.
Give us some operettas. Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
She is sort of your little Jewish grandmother. She is, my favorite story about Justice Ginsburg is that every morning they swear in dozens of members of the Supreme Court bar in a completely boring perfunctory ceremony that's been going on forever. And the eight other justices just, you know, snooze through it and shuffle through their papers. And she beams at every single one of the people as they're being sworn in.
And it's a giant moment for these lawyers.
Well, it is. And you know, I think some of the other justices forget how giant, but she really gives them her full Jewish grandma smile. And it's just a delight. It's a very humanizing part of the court.
Staunch left party leaner here, left-leaning justice.
Very left-leaning. She's certainly in that sort of Bush v. Gore four, and on particularly on, you know, civil rights issues, abortion, women's issues, affirmative action. She is not going anywhere but left.
Justice David Souter, our New Hampshire man.
He is a sort of funny, the sort of reclusive bachelor justice. While all the other justices jet off to Paris and Italy and junkets in the summer, he goes home to New Hampshire and, you know, shops at the local grocery store. He is the least jet-setting of the justices.
And this is not sufficiently full of gravitas, but you say you find him deliriously sexy. What's up?
Well, don't tell my husband, but I've been calling him the silver fox in my columns for years. But he really is. He has this wonderful patrician sort of 1940s actor look that just chills me.
Part of the liberal bloc again.
Also very liberal, and was a huge surprise because he was supposed to be a Bush appointee who was a slam-dunk right-winger, and he surprised everyone by turning out to be among the very consistent four votes on the left.
The other end of the nine who never leave, Antonin Scalia.
Right. He sits next to Souter but has nothing in common with him. Justice Scalia is a sort of little boiling pot of passionate, strong feelings, very, very much a Catholic and very, very passionately, for instance, pro-life. His feelings about things really sort of bubble over into his opinions, which are nevertheless, I think, among the most brilliant sort of crystalline thinking on the core.
You call him the intellectual godfather of the new federalism, moving power out to the states, the kind of new right approach.
Right. I mean, certainly Chief Justice Rehnquist is the sort of architect of the new federalism, of the sort of massive swing back from the Warren Court, giving power back to the states. But Scalia is really, I think, one of the great intellects who's been shaping the sort of jurisprudence of the Rehnquist Court.
Kennedy and Breyer, not quite as colorful a figure, certainly not the bullying type.
Right. Kennedy and Breyer are softer spoken, although quite different. Breyer is the one who asks the nine-part hypothetical that goes on and on while these poor attorneys who have very limited time to argue hop back and forth on one foot trying to get a word in.
You say he holds his head in his hand like Madonna voguing, so weighted with great thoughts.
Yeah, Breyer is great fun to watch. He's kind of a showman, and after he finishes asking a question, he sort of beams at his colleagues on the bench as sort of as if to say, am I funny?
The must-up crazy professor, you'd say.
Yeah, he's very much an intellectual and a real sort of counterpoint to some of the more sort of realistic, pragmatic members of the court.
And then John Paul Stevens, 83 now, eldest member of the court.
And not showing any signs of it, is still as vigorous, as on the ball, as certainly as he was 5 years ago when I started covering the court. What I like most about Stevens is he's got this very courtly, gentlemanly manner. He always politely thanks counsel for answering his questions.
Justice Clarence Thomas, the most controversial launch onto the Supreme Court, and his demeanor and his role now.
Well, I think Thomas is an enigma because he certainly is not a slouch. I mean, if you read his opinions, he is very much evolving as perhaps even more conservative a thinker than Justice Scalia, but he is not by any means an intellectual midget. He is, however, full of disdain for the process of oral argument. He asks maybe three or four questions an entire term.
An oral argument is the image, at least, that kind of defines the Supreme Court for many in the public.
Well, it's certainly the public face. I mean, we see nothing of what happens in conference. We don't see them writing opinions. And so this very, very clear act of sort of boredom and disdain, frequently his eyes are closed through oral argument. Frequently he's tilted back in his chair looking at the ceiling.
What's that about? Why doesn't Justice Thomas engage with oral argument?
Well, I mean, obviously that's for him to know, but I think the speculation is that he was so badly burned by the Anita Hill hearings during his confirmation, by the public shaming and disgrace, what he called his high-tech lynching, that he's never really forgiven the public for what we put him through, and as a result, he's sort of written us off.
But Dahlia Lithwick, you say it's not about disengagement on his part, that he's found his voice in his writing, it's that it's simply the more public aspect that he's not going to show much in.
I think that's it. I think he's simply made a decision, right or wrong, to sort of close himself off and protect himself from this public face of the court. It's maddening, by the way, as a reporter, because one never gets a sense of who he is, how he thinks. But he is certainly not going to change. He has no interest in what happens at oral argument for the most part.
Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, the only, the woman who may be the first and who may be or who might imagine herself as the successor to William Rehnquist, a character, a wonderful character, you say.
She is a great character. She's sort of the other grandmother on the court. She's very, very fact-specific. She is very much less a sort of sweeping doctrinal thinker and much more a sort of tell me the nuts and bolts of this case.
You call her an anti-feminist. Why? How?
Well, I mean, she has certainly not had a notorious respect for the little guy, the way Ginsburg's feminism leads her to sort of tend to, for instance, favor defendants or favor minorities. Justice O'Connor has a really sort of pick yourself up by the bootstraps. You know, I grew up on a tough ranch. And
you can
myself,
too.
You can too. So she really has, it's sort of the analog of what Justice Thomas has. You know, if I could make it as a minority, I'm not going to have a lot of patience for other minorities who bitch and moan.
But she's the key holding Roe v. Wade there. And finally, the Chief Justice himself, William Rehnquist, tell us something about his personality in the court, and then let's turn to his legacy. But first, his character there.
Well, Rehnquist is great fun. I think he's most famous for spontaneously putting gold bars on his black robe and sort of shocking everyone with this.
Really gussying up the outfit.
Theatricality, which was inspired by opera, no less.
Gilbert Rehnquist, and Sullivan, maybe.
Rehnquist is, he's a funny character because he's extremely formal. He is the person who is notorious, for instance, for chasing reporters out of the front seats of the press section if they're not in appropriate courtroom attire. If a woman is wearing a suit with pants in the front row, he will move her back. I mean, he wants his decorum.
Wow.
But at the same time, he's really presided over this massive sea change. As a jurisprudential matter, he is one of the most important formative chief justices we will ever have.
When he came into the Warren Court and during those years, and he's been there since 72 now, you had a famously left-leaning court, a lot of focus on minorities, civil rights, affirmative action. Then, year by year, comes the Rehnquist Revolution. How would you define it?
Well, I mean, I think there are a few pillars of it. I think that the big, big piece of it that he'll be remembered for is federalism, is for reviving this notion that states have rights, that the federal government has overreached. He's brought back the 10th Amendment of all things, which was something that nobody ever talked about, which reserves all rights to the states that are not granted to the federal government. He's cut into massive congressional acts that had never been questioned before, starting with Lopez, which was about the Gun-Free School Zone Act, and on into all these child porn protection acts. And suddenly here's a court saying Congress cannot do the thing that Congress has always done, which is massive sweeping social legislation. And so that's a huge piece of it. He's also really been key in kind of lowering the wall between church and state. I think last year's voucher case is a good example of a piece of Rehnquist court jurisprudence. You know, suddenly we're going to be giving money to religious schools. That would have been unheard of in the Warren court era.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the third important piece of it is a massive encroachment on defendants' rights, a massive resurgence of protection for police powers, a real respect for law and order. And finally, I think the thing that sort of binds all this up is that he really believes in the role of the court, that he has made the court paramount. And the best example of that is Bush v. Gore.
Jack Beatty, it cannot last forever. Politics and the clock are coming into play here. But what defines this man and his court for you?
Well, I don't really have time to get out my thought, but I'll try. Emerson said that institutions are the lengthened shadow of men, and I think this court is the lengthened shadow of Mr. Rehnquist. And when Richard Nixon appointed him, after ascertaining, he asked John Dean, he's not Jewish, is he? After he appointed him, he said to him, I've got a last piece of advice for you. So just be as mean and rough as they said you were. And he's lived up to that. And there is substantial evidence that I'd like to go into that he perjured himself on two occasions before the Senate about his past, and that in a sense he violated his oath of office. The first time was when he was nominated in 1971 and then into 72. He denied that he had been essentially been a challenger, a harasser of voters in Arizona during the 60s, when there were, I think, 14 different affidavits, including one from a former U.S. attorney, that he had done so. And even more critically, he denied that when he was a clerk for Justice Jackson in the 50s, he had written a memo that said, and I want to quote from it, that said that Plessy v. Ferguson was right and should be reaffirmed. It was in a memo urging Jackson to vote against Brown v. Board, and Plessy v. Ferguson was separate but equal, the segregation decision. Mm-hmm. He denied it at his hearing, and he said, no, that was the thought of Justice Jackson, which was a horrible smear of Jackson. As later scholarship developed, they looked at Jackson's verdict of vote. We came out of a hospital bed to vote for Brown v. Board of Education, and it was a smear of a dead man and a lie to the Senate.
I hear no embrace of this Chief Justice from Jack Beatty's corner. We're talking tonight about the legacy and the grand finale, perhaps, of William Rehnquist's Supreme Court. You can join the conversation at 1-800 1-800-423-8255. Will anything this court has done overshadow Bush v. Gore? Is that the legacy? And how have this court's decisions affected American life, affected your life? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the legacy and perhaps the looming grand finale of William Rehnquist's Supreme Court. The question for you is, has this been the court of your dreams or of your nightmares? Is 9 years too long for a Supreme Court to sit without turnover, without a new justice? And has the Rehnquist Court been the hands-off court of conservative dreams or, in fact, an activist court? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been talking with Dahlia Lithwick. She's senior editor and legal correspondent for Slate Magazine. I want to welcome into our conversation now Martin Belsky, joining us from Tulsa, Oklahoma. He's dean and professor of law at the University of Tulsa College of Law. Good evening and welcome, Professor Martin Belsky.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Well, thanks for being with us. There's a lot to talk about tonight. I guess first you've just been listening, and you heard some of Jack Beatty's pretty pointed critique of this Chief Justice and some of the things that he's that lie in his history, testifying and coming onto the court. Would you be that sharp in your judgment of Chief Justice Rehnquist's sworn statements?
Well, I'm not going to get into that kind of a shouting match about who's telling, who's shooting who, who's doing not. I really would prefer to look at what he's done while he's on the court. I think, by way of full disclosure, you know, I was on the House Judiciary Committee as a staff person when he was an assistant attorney general. In the wiretapping case, I do know, in fact, that he was asked to recuse himself from that case, and he didn't, even though he was involved in the drafting of that legislation, and that raised some issues at the time. But let's look at 2002 rather than 1971, 72, 73.
We're ready and eager. How do you see, how would you describe, define the legacy of this man and this court?
I think there's a couple important points to note. One is he's a very pleasant person to deal with on the court. Chief Justice Berger was supposed to have changed the Warren Court. He didn't. It was confrontational. Rehnquist, by not just the fact of his leadership and his basic gentlemanly courteousness with individuals. And if you talk to Breyer and you talk to Ginsburg and you talk to people who disagree with him all the time, they all comment on that. But he's had a period of time to mold this court, a long period of time, gradually taking some steps in the areas that were mentioned by Ms. Lithwick, essentially molding the court to a new conservative court. The court that everybody thought the Berger Court would be, the Rehnquist Court has turned out to be. Mm. And although many of the decisions are 5-4, some are 6-3. And even a change of one justice will not make that much difference. And I think those changes are fundamental, at least for my lifetime. And the basic one, I think was mentioned already, is federalism.
Mm-hmm.
It would be hard for me to believe, looking back in history, that we would have said the Americans with Disabilities Act, for that the Aging Act, that you could not sue a state official for violation of those acts. I would have never, ever imagined that to have happened, but it did. I would never imagine someone saying the Commerce Clause, which I used to spend literally 20 minutes in class on, I now have to spend 2 weeks in explaining to the students that there are limits to what the Commerce Clause will allow Congress to do. Those are fundamental changes, long-term changes affecting what Congress can do and what the states can do. And that will have a much more lasting impact than Bush versus Gore.
Martin Belsky, pull that thread through for those of us who are not attorneys and have not watched as closely as you for as long as you, how that kind of change in judicial view actually changes the quality of American life and politics. What stamp does that put on the body politic, on the nation?
We are used to having major decisions involving civil rights, civil liberties, handling of the problems at the national level. We use our congressmen, we use our senators, we pass a disabilities law, we pass a civil rights law, we pass an aging law, we pass a law having to do with environmental protection, we pass a land use law. In all those situations, we went to the national government, asked them to pass laws, and they were binding on the states.
And I think most people assume that they still can and do and will.
Well, now I think there are limits. There are limits in two ways. One, there's a limit. The court has begun to say that there are limits on how far the Congress can go in passing legislation, period. And second of all, the court has said there are severe limits by the 11th Amendment, which doesn't say anything at all about suing the states, but it's been interpreted that. There are limits about suing state government officials for violation of law. So, for example, right now, you can sue a private person for a violation of the Disabilities Act, but you can't sue the state. You can't sue a private person for an age discrimination, and you can't sue the state. And I think you're going to find that legacy continue on in other areas. They've already indicated when it comes to education, when it comes to gun control, when it comes to criminal justice, they are going to bend over backwards to say the states retain the power and not the federal government. Those are fundamental changes and an attitude and a perspective going back to pre-Roosevelt days.
How does a fundamental change like that filter into public consciousness? I think most Americans still think of Congress sitting down with ultimate power and with states having to fall in line. What does it take in terms of demonstrated evidence of this change of years for Americans to reimagine their view of the country as really and truly being a collection of 50 rather autonomous states?
I think the change will occur because of two decisions the last 3 years, one on aging and one on disability, where a number of individuals are going to find out that they can't sue in the federal courts their state agencies for violation of certain rights. And that's going to take some while to filter through the system, but eventually you're going to understand. It's going to also mean you're going to find that legislation that were being proposed, and you go to your congressman, you go to your senator and ask them to put it in, and they're going to go through the process, and then they'll turn around and they won't be able to pass it. Mm-hmm. Things having to do with education. I mean, we talk about education. Now, one caveat, and I have to say this caveat, whether or not this pro-states rights issue will continue post 9/11 is the big unknown.
Because of security concerns?
That's right. In other words, they have said for years, last 6 to 7 years, that, for example, you could not have gun control legislation requiring local police officers to implement gun control issues. That's a violation of state rights. Well, I wonder in a post 9/11 world, would they say the same thing today? Would they say that you could not have a national bill that requires gun registration and requires information to be collected by the local sheriff? I'm not sure. I don't know the answer to that question because it's post 9/11.
And it's a test that may come up in this term, or we begin to see in this term.
I think you're going to find a bunch of this stuff having come up, and you're also going to find the other Ashcroft bill, not yours. You know,
Ashbrook, please. Ashbrook.
I know, I'm teasing. Yeah. But I'm saying that you're going to find that a lot of that legislation going through is talking about a national police force, and the Rehnquist conservative court has made comment after comment about their concerns about federal police powers and federal criminal justice powers. And so now we have a conflict of two conservative points of view, and how that's going to wind up, I can't predict. If I could predict it, I could probably make a lot of money or work for some of the publications your other commentators are doing.
You've put a lot on the table here, Martin Belsky. Dahlia Lithwick, let me turn to you. I guess two things. One, with the massive kind of change, fundamental change that you and Martin Belsky are describing this evening, is there a sense in the Rehnquist court majority of triumphalism? Is there a kind of intellectual high-fiving here? And beyond that, how does... A conservative court, which you might expect to be a quiet court, justify or square these kind of rather hugely influential court decisions?
Well, I think that there is a sort of wonderful unifying theme in the Rehnquist court, and for this I credit former Solicitor General Walter Dellinger, who sort of points out that the unifying theme is that Congress seems to really, really hate Congress and love the states until it comes time to hate the states and love Congress. Mm-hmm. There's not, in other words, as soon as it seems as though the court is bending over backward to privilege sort of some element of decentralized government, it turns out that the thing that they love most is the centralized court. And so the unifying theme is that the court is very, very glad to take power away from the states and give it to themselves, very happy to take away power from Congress and give it to themselves. And so it's really, you know, I think that how they square it is, and this is really revolutionary, I mean, it goes back to the very first Supreme Court that said, you know, we get to pass on whether a congressional act is in fact constitutional, mm-hmm. which was not intuitively obvious. Mm-hmm. This is a court that's sort of taking that the next step. This is a court that is very, very comfortable saying we have this remarkable supremacy over Congress and the states. And so I think it's really important to notice that whenever it seems as though this court is sort of bending over backwards to give power back, ultimately, what's being asserted most strongly is we have the prerogative to do that. And I think that's really important.
If I can follow up, and I want to agree
yes,
with
Martin,
Barry, and just point out the situation and conflicts between the executive branch and the legislative branch, the court has said we're going to have a strict construction. when it comes to conflicts between the executive branch and judicial branch, they'll say we'll be more pragmatic and we win. Similarly, when it comes to issues between the state government and the federal government, they usually are saying more and more the state government is. When issues come between the state government and the United States Supreme Court, again, the United States Supreme Court says we win. I totally agree that when it comes to national power, national judicial power, they are very willing to intervene. Any other situation, they are much more willing to limit the power of the federal government.
Listeners, we're talking about the legacy and perhaps the looming grand finality of William Rehnquist's long-sitting court. Is 9 years too long for Supreme Court to sit without turnover, without a new justice? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Jack Beatty, do you find yourself surprised that a court in the hands of William Rehnquist would have such a conservative, would have such a kind of revolutionary legacy?
Well, yeah. I mean, except if you buy the business that they're, you know, they're not judicially active. I mean, their whole jurisprudence is federalism, except when it comes to Bush v. Gore. All that goes out the window, and they say, oh, no, now the states are wrong. So it seems as if ideology and politics have driven this court. And in the book that Professor Belsky edited, there was a very good essay by an Erwin Chemerinsky.
Chemerinsky.
I beg your pardon.
Chemerinsky. Got it. Right. Yeah.
Got it.
Okay.
And I thought he made a very good point about the fundamental philosophy at the bottom of a lot of these decisions, which is this notion of original meaning, that you stick to the original text of the Constitution. And what I didn't realize is that as Rehnquist and his compeers work this out, they not only mean what the Constitution said, that increasingly they cite what was happening in the world around the Constitution, and they cite historical events. And the professor makes the good point. He says, you know, the framers didn't mean to constitutionalize the practices of 1789. And yet that seems to be the logical, the key that they open up the law with, this original meaning. And it sounds as if it's a kind of, that it just doesn't hold up logically or historically.
Martin Belsky, do you buy that something out of whack?
As Mr. B said, it's even more significant than that, because what they are doing is putting themselves back into 1789. And if you read some of the things Justice Thomas, and he is the leading person on this issue, going back to the environment of this generation, and he is going back and saying, let's see what people were thinking at this time, and going back into that kind of historical record. And Justice Scalia has been following that. And Erwin's comment in his article was essentially saying, you know, you really can't do that because we're not there. We don't have a time machine yet. We can't go back and do that. Not only that, but 1789 is fundamentally different than 2002. But this is the basic debate we have on original intent that's been going on. The difference is there's three justices now, and sometimes five, that buy it.
And they are holding sway and have for a long time. Dolly Lithwick, Martin Belsky, Jack Beatty, stand by. We have a lot of callers who want to join us. Nate's calling from Appleton, Wisconsin. Hi, Nate. You're on the air.
Yeah, if you follow the logic that you guys were just enumerating, black people are three-fourths of white people.
If we go back to 1789.
The federal government historically, at least in the last 50 years, was the place where the weak, the dispossessed, the dispirited, they turned to the federal government because the local power elites had the ability to dominate state legislatures and governors. Now, you know, when you have issues that were specific and reflected local attitudes or prejudice, and obviously the best example of that is segregation, the federal government was the only place where people could turn to. And it's interesting because conservatives, generally, regardless of what country you're in, they seek to preserve established power centers. And here in the United States, we have a Supreme Court that's hostile to the use of the federal government to redress power imbalances. And given the history of this country, it's tragic that the institution that gave us Gideon versus Wainwright, where, you know, a lone, poor, penniless black person in Florida could turn to a writ of certiorari and get the Supreme Court to step in to defend his rights, that institution has been twisted under this majority. And as a consequence of that, what I expect and hope is that if there is a vacancy on the Supreme Court, I want the Democrats on the Judiciary Committee and in the Senate to be fiercely, fiercely partisan and make sure that at the most a moderate or centrist is placed on the court in order to redress the extreme outliers that we have now on the court. Scalia and Thomas do not represent the thinking of the average American. And I don't think...
Nate, I got to come in here, but I think you put your finger right on it. We're going to talk about the view ahead. But Dahlia Lithwick, first of all, I mean, Martin Belsky lays it out, and Nate jumps right on it, saying not only is this a kind of 1789 perspective, but the whole country is, in effect, being put in a time machine and shipped back there in some sense. Do you think this court and the conservative members of it would buy that?
Well, I am laughing that I'm the person who's going to defend the Federalist position for a second, but I would respond by saying I really think that if you look at Thomas, you look at Scalia and Rehnquist and what they're doing, they have anthropomorphized the states. And when they talk about returning dignity, and that's the quote you'll find, to the states, they truly believe that what suffered under the Warren Court and the sort of revolution of thinking about the little guy that your caller refers to is that the states were what suffered. And so I think it's important. I mean, I think that the reason that they would resist and push back on what you're talking about is they would say this, first and foremost, is a country made up of states that have dignity, that have certain rights that have been glossed over, and they're trying to return out. Now, whether or not you agree with that project is one thing, but I think it's important to put it on the table and explain that really is the project.
And in fact, Jack, there, Justice Thomas is looking at the Articles of Confederation. he's really saying that, we are states first, and then we're a national government.
Martin Belsky, can the court anthropomorphize states, to use Dahlia's term, without diminishing individuals?
Well, that's the key question, and it really then depends on how far the states are going to go. And as Mr. Lithwick said, sometimes, sometimes we don't know how far they're going to go. I want to make a real quick comment on one thing
yes.
your previous caller said, which I think is an important statement, which could be easily missed.
Mm-hmm.
As the court has set up this agenda of change, and really has, and they're pretty secure in that agenda of change, and as they take fewer and fewer cases, there's going to be less of an opportunity to change some of these cases by action before the court. That's why these fights are occurring on the courts of appeal so much.
You mean they're closing the door behind them somehow?
Yeah, they're turning things back to the states. They say, we've set out the ground rules. It's now up to the circuit courts and the federal system and the district courts to make their decisions. It's now up to the state courts to make their decisions. And that's why you're finding many more confirmation battles at the district court level. I was counsel House Judiciary Committee. We didn't see battles over like this.
Yeah.
Many more battles on the district court level and the court of appeals levels to interpret these things. And if you have conservative judges interpreting conservative opinions, you're going to have a carrying out of a broad sort of agenda of change.
Is that related to why the Supreme Court is hearing fewer cases? Is this court essentially one by one turning out the lights at the Supreme Court and pushing it down the chain?
I think that they are setting the agenda, and they have much more confidence in the beginning. They took more cases when they had some of the Warren Court holdovers, some of the Democratic appointments, and they're taking fewer and fewer. I'm not saying things are not said publicly. Justice Thomas was here, and he spoke, and Justice Breyer was here, and Justice Ginsburg, and they all spoke about this. And Justice Thomas, as was stated before, he said, I don't believe in oral argument. You heard that comment before.
Right.
He said it explicitly. He said, I think it's a waste of time. If we're not smart enough to know what's going on before we go into the courtroom, nobody's going to change our mind. And he has made that very explicit. But the other issues, they sort of made it clear that they believe, at least the conservative justices believe, that it's their job to set the agenda, and it's the job of the lower federal courts to carry out that agenda.
We've got to take a short break. Martin Belsky, we're talking about the legacy and perhaps the grand finale coming up of William Rehnquist's Supreme Court. You can hear we're talking about issues of moment here tonight. Has this court been the court of your dreams or nightmares? And do you welcome or dread the breakup of the Rehnquist Court? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the legacy and maybe the upcoming grand finale of William Rehnquist's Supreme Court, about the Rehnquist Revolution and the country that it sits above. Has the Supreme Court gained or lost stature in the Rehnquist years, in your view? And are you confident this court will protect civil liberties and security, I guess, both in the term ahead? Or, as we've heard earlier tonight, is security becoming kind of the new litmus test? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-8255. 423-TALK. My guests tonight are Dahlia Lithwick. She's senior editor and legal correspondent for Slate magazine, co-author of I Will Sing Life, Voices from the Hole in the Wall Gang Camp, and author of the forthcoming book of Legal Humor, due out in February next year. And Martin Belsky, joining us from Tulsa, Oklahoma, dean and professor of law at the University of Tulsa College of Law, editor of the Rehnquist Court, Farewell to the Old Order in the Court. Martin Belsky, what's your sense of the effect of the longevity of this unit, this eight men and one woman who have been together in now into their ninth term? How do you think the dynamic of that has worked into the profile that this court now presents?
I think it works in the sense that they sort of all know where they're coming from, and it's a highly unusual case when they can't predict what's going to happen, and they sort of therefore have not as much need to get together and talk about things. They also have fought the battles. They can be more friendly with each other. It's not a constant harassment back and forth. But the most significant thing is that they really understand the relationship of what they're doing to what's happening. A new justice in the court still has that excitement, still has that feeling of awe about what they're doing, and part of a learning experience is willing to sort of get involved. And as I was said earlier by one of the commentators, it is essentially a court of personalities. They figured out their own personalities, but more important, they know everybody else's personality.
Terry's calling from Manitowoc, Wisconsin. Hi, Terry. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing?
Real well, thanks.
My question regards how the complacency of a long-term justice such that we've had, how their decisions are affected by special interests and or personal agendas or legacies they care to leave. And I will take my answer off the air.
Okay, Terry, thanks for your call. Dahlia, I guess this comes back in a way to the same issue about these nine people sitting together for such a long time. And Terry asks a question that a lot of people would ask. Well, I guess special interest, I don't know how that figures in. Maybe you've got a view, but personal views, when people sit together for so long, does it mute or magnify the very personal views of each justice?
Well, I think that the simple answer to that is Bush v. Gore. I mean, I think that was a case where personal views utterly triumphed over, you know, the rule of law and doctrine and, you know, years of personal jurisprudence. So I think there's no question, and you know, I don't think it's demagogic from me to say that this is a court that is very ideological, and that when push comes to shove, they really manifest it. I think it's important to know, though, that this court really does have a healthy respect for each other, and I think that the nice thing that comes with this longevity is that you have very deep friendships, for instance, between Justice Scalia and Justice Ginsburg, who are sort of could not be more ideologically opposite and yet have such a profound and healthy respect for each other, both as friends and as intellectuals. And I think that really is one of the sort of nice things that is fostered with long-time relationships. You can sort of come to really respect your differences.
Mm-hmm. Martin, sorry, Dahlia.
No, I was going to say, and I do think it, your caller makes an important point, that people are thinking about their legacy on this court. You know, mm-hmm. And no one more so than Chief Justice Rehnquist, who has put such a massive thumbprint on history, that he has to be thinking, you know, as he makes decisions about if and when to step down, mm-hmm. what is the legacy that he is leaving behind?
Mm-hmm. Mark's calling from Bedford, New Hampshire. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to comment on the issue of states' rights. I do think that the current Supreme Court has protected states' rights, but I think they've gone a long way toward protecting individual rights as well. Even with the so-called conservative bent of the existing court, they have chosen to leave abortion rights, so-called abortion rights, as they are. And some of the other callers and the panelists that you have on board mm-hmm. seem to think that the court is some part of some conservative conspiracy, and I disagree with that viewpoint entirely. I think with the Clinton appointees combined with the past Republican appointees, I think the Supreme Court has maintained somewhat of a balance.
Mark, thanks for the view. Martin Belsky, what about it? As we've moved power to the states, have individuals been protected, whether or not as a class, but as individuals?
We have to go case by case. Free expression of First Amendment, they have been surprisingly liberal and continuous in the past. Separation of church and state. The vouchers case, you know, people would predict from earlier cases where they talked about, but on First Amendment free speech issues, on criminal justice, they'd be just much more conservative. I don't think anybody can question how much more conservative they are on those issues. On equal protection issues, they have been much more conservative, including Civil Rights Act all the way up and down, except, of course, in Bush v. Gore, which is correct. But otherwise, they have been very conservative. On issues having to do, you know, with individual rights, you really have to look and see what you're talking about. I mean, they really do change from issue to issue, and some of that is personal, and some of that is certain. It's not the court. We sort of can predict, and on the abortion case, it's Justice O'Connor. I mean, it's a simple statement of that, although we heard the comment before, she's not a feminist. On this issue, she chose to protect the woman. She said, we have to protect the woman. She even said, you can't require a woman to get permission from a spouse. Parents are a different issue. She was protective. So you have to go issue by issue on those situations. But generally, overall, giving more power back to the states will mean that you'll go state by state for different rights.
Jack Beatty, how do you see the American individual, man or woman, standing in the light of this court's justice?
Well, of course, I'm also thinking of the flag-burning case, which, to go back to what our caller, Mark, was saying, this was an example of them upholding a personal right that I never thought we even had. So that was quite remarkable. But, you know, Justice Warren used to say, is it fair? That was the question he asked. And that court made a revolution in American life. I was alive then, and I know the difference that court made in Americans' lives for the better. And I just don't think you can say that about this court. I'm not sure it's for the worse, but I just don't see that they have really moved on and tried to expand rights at all, that it's just been the other way around, identifying with authority. And indeed, the Chief Justice in a book on civil liberties in wartime said very favorable things about the internment of the Japanese and the Supreme Court decisions involving that, which is kind of shocking to think that he's now going to be ruling on similar kinds of cases.
Well, we're going to have to save that docket upcoming for another night, I'm afraid. We're out of time just on the legacy alone, but what a conversation. I'm so glad to have had it. Martin Belsky, thank you for joining us tonight.
My pleasure. Truly enjoyed it.
Martin Belsky is Dean and Professor of Law at the University of Tulsa College of Law. And Dahlia Lithwick, tremendous to have you on. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Dahlia Lithwick is Senior Editor and Legal Correspondent for Slate Magazine. She's got a forthcoming book of legal humor coming out in February 2003. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Log on to onpointradio.org and click on Forums. In a moment, a look inside the Senate's debate on Iraq. This is On Point. Debate over President Bush's war resolution began this week on Capitol Hill, and while several vocal critics of the resolution have emerged, the vast majority of speakers have supported President Bush. Even Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle told reporters today that he is inclined to vote in favor of the resolution. And Massachusetts Democrat John Kerry told his Senate colleagues that he supports the war resolution with certain conditions. Here's an excerpt of what Senator Kerry had to say during today's debate.
When I vote to give the President of the United States the authority to use force if necessary to disarm Saddam Hussein, because I believe that a deadly arsenal of weapons of mass destruction in his hands is a threat, and a grave threat to our security and that of our allies in the Persian Gulf region, I will vote because I believe it is the best way to hold Saddam Hussein accountable. And the administration, I believe, now is committed to a recognition that war must be the last option to address this threat, not the first, and that we must act in concert with allies around the globe to make the world's case against Saddam Hussein. As the President made clear earlier this week, quote, approving this resolution does not mean that military action is imminent or unavoidable. It means that America speaks with one voice. So let me be clear. The vote that I will give to the President is for one reason and one reason only, to disarm Iraq of weapons of mass destruction if we cannot accomplish that objective through new tough weapons inspection in joint concert with our allies. In giving the president this authority, I expect him to fulfill the commitments he has made to the American people in recent days, to work with the United Nations Security Council, to adopt a new resolution setting out tough immediate inspection requirements, and to act with our allies at our side if we have to disarm Saddam Hussein by force. If he fails to do so, I will be among the first to speak out. If we do wind up going to war with Iraq, it is imperative that we do so with others in the international community, unless there is a showing of a grave imminent, and I emphasize imminent, threat to this country, which requires the president to respond in a way that protects our immediate national security needs. The administration may not be in the habit of building coalitions, but that's what they need to do here. And it's what can be done. If we go it alone without reason, we risk inflaming an entire region, breeding a new generation of terrorists, a new cadre of anti-American zealots, and we will be less secure, not more secure, at the end of the day, even with Saddam Hussein disarmed. Let there be no doubt or confusion about where we stand on this. I will support a multilateral effort to disarm him by force if we have exhausted those other options, as the president has promised. But I will not support a unilateral U.S. war against Iraq unless that threat is imminent and the multilateral effort has not proven possible under any circumstances. In voting to grant the president the authority, I am not giving him carte blanche to run roughshod over every country that poses or may pose some kind of potential threat to the United States. Every nation has the right to act preemptively, but if it faces an imminent and grave threat for its self-defense under the standards of law. The threat we face today with Iraq does not meet that test yet, and I emphasize yet. Yes, it is grave because of the deadliness of Saddam Hussein's arsenal and the very high probability that he might use these weapons one day if not disarmed, but it is not imminent. And no one in the CIA, no intelligence briefing we have had, suggests it is imminent. The argument for going to war against Iraq is rooted in enforcement of the international community's demand that he disarm. It is not rooted in the doctrine of preemption. Nor is the grant of authority in this resolution an acknowledgement that Congress accepts or agrees with the president's new strategic doctrine of preemption. Just the opposite. This resolution clearly limits the authority given to the president to use force in Iraq and Iraq only, and for the specific purpose of defending the United States against the threat posed by Iraq and enforcing relevant Security Council resolutions.
Senator John Kerry, Democrat of Massachusetts, speaking on the Senate floor earlier today. Jack Beatty, a fascinating bit of a speech here. Senator Kerry says that he's going to vote for this resolution because he believes the Bush administration is committed to the view that war is the last option. He says, I'm not giving the president carte blanche. But is that true? Once he's signed on here, once this is passed, the president has carte blanche, doesn't he?
Well, it seems to me he does under the resolution. And but just a word on the politics here. All five Democrats holding office, Edwards, Gephardt, Daschle, Lieberman, and now Kerry, six, are all signed on for the war. We don't know about Howard Dean. This tells me that if I were Al Gore and I were looking for something that would differentiate me from the pack, and I realized that Democrats who vote in primaries are more liberal than other Democrats, I think I would find a real strong anti-war position, and he's already begun to stake that territory out. So I think that you've got to differentiate yourself in a presidential campaign, and I think Gore, if he runs, has his factor here.
The president has really opened a window for these Democrats by saying in his recent remarks that war is the last option, yet we have seen for months tremendous preparation for war as a real option.
Yeah, we sure have, and I think all depends now on this UN resolution and on whether we can get whether it can be passed by the Security Council and whether Saddam Hussein will essentially say yes, I agree. But if he doesn't, there's liable to be war. There's very likely to be war.
And Senator John Kerry will have left himself a long list of complaints that he can make beyond the simple act of signing on. But he is signed on along with what looks like quite a majority now. Jack Beatty, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBU.